All right. Thank you for having me back. Good morning. I'm Sarah Kornfield. It's a real pleasure to be with you this morning and to share some of my research with you. Today, my focus is on Christian appeals to freedom or religious liberty, on what it looks like when evangelical Christians talk about freedom and in their sermons and political speeches and the like. And I'd like to begin with an anecdote. So once upon a time, I was teaching at a small liberal arts Christian college, and a student approached me at the end of class, and he told me he was going to miss the next week of classes because he was going to home to Texas for his church's men's advance. And I looked about as puzzled as most of you do, and so he chuckled and he said, "Men don't retreat in Texas." He was going on a men's retreat, yeah, but his church was calling it a men's advance. So this was a while ago, but the moment really stuck me because it perfectly brings together some intertwinings of Christianity, masculinity, regionalism, Texas. So men don't retreat in Texas, not even the Christian ones, maybe especially not the Christian ones. Yet this Texan church's ideology, men don't retreat, it echoes across a much larger sort of chord in U.S. culture. To be a man and a Christian is to advance the gospel, your family, your way of life against the ramparts of secular culture. So that's the background. The research I'm sharing today is co-authored with a colleague whose name is Sage Mickelson. She and I began analyzing white Christian appeals to freedom, and we chose to study it in its most banal and homegrown context, that pastoral advice. As evangelical Christians, Sage and I have heard at least one sermon a week each our entire lives, and as meticulously crafted and as well-prepared as good preaching can be, we know that this rhetoric is the normal, the meal, not the dessert, if you will. We know also that this is the rhetoric that shapes congregations week in and week out. We both have also called Texas home, so we selected Texas pastor Jonathan J.P. Polkluda's sermon series, which he helpfully publishes in books. I brought props. So he helpfully publishes these sermon series in books, and so we are studying his two most recent books, and that's what I'll share with you today, Outdated, and then Why Do I Do What I Don't Want to Do? And if that mouthful of a title alerted you, that second book is a pastoral riff on Romans chapter 7, and it focuses on the Christian virtues. Polkluda pastors a white evangelical megachurch in Waco, Texas. But his influence is national through speaking engagements, social media, and of course his book series. If you Google him, you'll find him on Twitter and Instagram and all of the other places. Our central contention is that this Christian rhetoric, its appeals conflate freedom and sovereignty within a masculinized framework. It's a little bit messy, so I'll try to bring these themes together for us today. We're studying freedom, this concept of sovereignty, and how they intertwine in masculinity. But to put it most simply, for Christians in the United States, to be free is to be king. To be free is to be in control of terrain. Conversely, to be not free is to be held captive, to not be in control, to be confined in a cage. Synthesizing across the literature on white Christian appeals to freedom, which I won't go in too deeply here, but we got to talk about in our pre-conversation, there are essentially three recurring topics. When Christians argue on behalf of religious liberty, there are three topics that come up, and so we'll work through those together today with Polkluda's sermons. The three are, first, a battle between good and evil. Second, an emphasis on the idea of God as creator and therefore as definer of people's truest selves or the truest nature of things. And then third, a recurring central dominant concern with gender roles. So, I'm going to begin with the battle between good and evil in Pokluda's pastoral advice. So Pokluda promises that by following his advice, Christians can leave behind the deadly vices and instead find, quote, the same freedom I have. Pokluda structures his most recent book, this one, in two parts, which he titles The Ancient Battles and then The Modern Wars. And in each chapter, he pits an individualistic vice and virtue against each other. So importantly, this is not actually an Aristotelian understanding of virtue, which would put virtue as the middle between two extremes. Rather, Pokluda is going like vice, virtue in battle. Okay, so his virtues and vices, they go like this, like, pride versus humility, cynicism versus optimism. And this battle's arranged ancient and modern so that all of history and every moment of every single day can be seen as a battle between virtue and vice, between freedom and captivity, between Christianity and Satan. And Satan appears as the chief villain in this metaphor. Pokluda writes explicitly about Satan, repeatedly making statements such as, quote, the spiritual war is real and Satan hates you. And, quote, we have an enemy, Satan, who is not of this world and wants nothing more than for our sins to devour us and destroy our lives. Personifying evil as Satan, Pokluda provides a clear external adversary in this battle and clearly stipulates that the battle originates with Satan. Satan attacks us. We have no choice but to fight under those conditions. Throughout Why Do I Do What I Don't Want to Do, Pokluda repeatedly and metaphorically uses words and phrases such as victory, battle, packs a heavy punch, fight, guard, captive, execute, kill, ammo, win, lose. For instance, Pokluda refers to prayer and scripture meditation as Christians' best ammo. These metaphoric terms cluster around explicit imagery of sin as captivity. This imagery is so central to his writing, and it echoes throughout a whole lot of other sermon places, that I provided an excerpt for it for you in the reading, in the bulletin, and I am going to read his main metaphor for us here. I'll try to emphasize the metaphor parts. When you are trapped in sin, imagine yourself in a cage. The door is locked. And as you look around, you see many others in cages too. But because of the gospel, Jesus comes and unlocks the cage. He leaves the door open and invites you to walk out. And as you step out of the cage that held you prisoner, he gives you the key to the cage, which is your story. Every time we share our story and tell what God has saved us from, our sin loses power over us and others are freed from their cages. Do not be ashamed of your story. Do not hide it. Use the story God has saved you from by his kindness to walk freely out of your cage and invite others to do the same. So this metaphoric image juxtaposes slavery and captivity with Christianity and freedom. In Pokluda's imagery, Christians need to walk out of their cages, which involves an ongoing battle against Satan as Satan attempts to force Christians back into their cages. Indeed, when writing about dating and marriage in Outdated, Pokluda insisted that the most important feature to look for in a romantic partner is a battle partner. Using his own relationship as an example, Pokluda writes, I don't need a trophy wife by my side. I need someone to go into battle with me. Although, as he notes, his wife is also very physically attractive. More on that later. So, Pokluda's cage imagery clearly situates freedom. Freedom is on the other side of victory. For Christians, arrayed in a battle between good and evil, we can't be free until we win. So there's battle. Freedom's on the other side of victory. But what is freedom like? Well, this brings us to the second main sort of organizing feature of the discourse on religious liberty, and that's the concept of God's definitions. Pokluda argues that God has designed humanity to live best, to live free, when we live by following his design. But this doesn't mean doing what you want. And it certainly doesn't mean following your instincts, right? Despite being designed for this free life, following your instincts doesn't get you there. Instead, It takes a lot of really manly effort to live free. So Pulkuta describes freedom as hard won through self-control. Freedom is obtained through a hard-fought, quote, daily grind. And there's an equivocation here between self-control and freedom that works because the alternative in Pulkuta's writing and sermons is captivity. So either Christians stay in the cage or they fight for freedom through self-control. Pulkuta makes this dichotomy explicit as he writes, for instance, about lust, stating, quote, "We will either control our sexual desires or be controlled by them. Living with self-control takes effort and intentionality." Doubling down on this either-or approach, right, freedom or captivity, right, slavery or self-control, Pulkuta puts salvation on the line. In the conclusion of his book, Why Do I Do What I Don't Want to Do, Pulkuta writes that if readers continue to willfully sin as defined in his book, and his definitions of sin are very broad, he says, if you continue to willfully sin, you need to ask yourself, do I really know this Christ? I cannot explain how much of a sucker punch this question is for Christians, but perhaps you already know. The question, do you really know Christ? It hits hard. And yet I want to pause and note first that Scripture cautions against judging others, and second, during the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus claims that it is he who will know his disciples, and not the other way around. Pulkuta's pastoral advice draws extremely harsh either-or dichotomies within battle. Christians are either living entirely free, self-controlled, or they are Satan's slaves and not Christians. For Christians, the provocation to be sovereign over one's own freedom through self-control and adherence to extremely narrow imaginations of God's design, it's never been higher. And all of this brings us to gender roles. For those unfamiliar with white Christian rhetoric, it might seem a little bit strange that the cosmic battle of good and evil hinges on heterosexuality and traditional gender roles. But it does. For Pulkuta, the modesty of my own apparel is a linchpin in this cosmic war. Pulkuta believes in evangelism. He believes in spreading the gospel. He believes in freeing the world and winning the war against Satan. He believes that when men and women follow God's supposedly gendered designs for our lives, when men lead and women follow within loving, monogamous, heterosexual marriages, there will be, quote, revival, creating a great awakening as Christianity spreads like wildfire through the witness of godly marriages. Pulkuta then offers a lot of advice that focuses on women being passive, cautioning, for instance, that asking a man out on a date, as I did with my spouse, will lead to a passive husband and a controlling wife, which he likens to the original sin between Adam and Eve. There's a lot of pretty fairly boilerplate gender roles in this pastoral advice. These are my favorites. He describes women as so emotionally complex that we are confused a lot of the time because we feel multiple feelings simultaneously. And thus we need men's clarity and leadership to remove our confusion. All of this advice fits within complementarian doctrine, which teaches that God designed men and women for different roles and that in God's goodness and freedom can't be experienced outside of those patriarchal roles. And this brings us back to sovereignty. When evangelicals talk about freedom, they're talking about sovereignty, right? Freedom is on the other side of victory. Freedom is total control of your metaphorical terrain. Freedom is being sovereign. And sovereignty as a concept, and you'll find this also in your bulletins, sovereignty as a concept has to do with how nation states create borders and organize space, how they wield power over particular areas. In democratic nation states, the people retain their freedom, consenting to governance and holding their elected officials accountable. At least in theory, then, the people are free and sovereign. As such, who counts as the people is of utmost importance. And here, without going into too much social contract theory, it becomes apparent that in the United States, sovereignty has always been about personhood. The white-propertied men who built the U.S. Constitution understood their right to sovereign freedom as derived from their whiteness and their manhood and their propertiedness. And although many constitutional amendments and sweeping legislation has sought to broaden personhood in the United States, the rights to freedom and sovereignty continue to be linked to those most recognizable as full persons. And it's pretty clear that the ideology in Pocluda's pastoral advice sees women not quite so much as persons as props. His books are full of stories about beautiful women who purposefully tempt him and whose siren song of lust he manfully resists. For instance, in January of last year, he gave a sermon with an anecdote recounting how a, quote, perfect, physically beautiful woman with, quote, everything in the right place, sexually propositioned him at a local neighborhood restaurant, think Chili's, while he was having dinner with a friend. Okay, even taking this anecdote at face value, this is a pretty weird sermon. Okay, but as feminist religious scholar Sheila Way Gregory stated, this sermon invites, quote, men to judge every woman around them on the basis of where their body parts land. And that women want to go to church without having to hear a pastor call his wife smoking hot. Or brag about the host of women who want to have sex with him. Or tell us how hard it is for Christian men not to lust. Pocluda routinely brags about these things. And he brags about his sex life prior to becoming a Christian. Here, sociologist Sarah Diefendorf notes that Christian men often seem to relish describing struggles with lusting over women's bodies, since these performances situate them as manly and therefore powerful while still being holy, or at least monogamous. Additionally, this type of discourse reduces women to props in men's stories. To bring it back to sovereignty, in this pastoral advice, men are most obviously persons, and women are body parts in the right places. Moreover, in this pastoral advice, black people, people of color, are never mentioned. Although Africa exists, and he recommends that Christians go there on short-term missionary trips. Right. Also, despite writing an entire book about dating and marriage, LGBTQ plus people do not seem to exist in Plocluda's pastoral advice. As a rhetorical scholar, we call this type of pointed ignoring the third persona, which is just a fancy way of saying the excluded, the not us, the them, the other. Put this back in the context of freedom and sovereignty, and we're thinking about who is excluded from we the people, who's being excluded from deciding America's future. And just a quick foray into current political or cultural parlance, if somebody says that childless cat ladies don't deserve to have much of a say in the future of America as married couples, right? Like, that's exactly what we're talking about. Like, you're hearing it right there. That's the sovereignty bit, right? You're less. You don't get to say. You're not quite we the people. So here, I want to be very clear that Pocluda never talks about politics in his pastoral advice. He doesn't have to. His advice is profoundly ideological. Pocluda calls Christians to battle for terrain, to fight for sovereignty, to inhabit traditional gender roles, to be free. Pocluda welcomes his readers into a war he claims is already happening. He trains them to see everything as individualistic, ignoring oppression and structural injustice, and he baptizes heterosexism as God's design for humanity. Pocluda does not need to tell you how to vote. If you follow his advice, you go on the offense, fighting for freedom, and this entails a whole range of interpersonal and political behaviors. This also reimagines the gospel. So I'm going to end with an anecdote here. I was talking to my mom about my research. She's Texan. I was telling her about how Pocluda describes prayer as ammo. I was telling her about sovereignty and men's advances, the very masculine ways these appeals are made. We were on the phone. There was a long pause. And then my mom, who is the quintessential good Christian woman, she said something like, I don't like the way any of this sounds, but honey, Christians have to stand our ground. We have to fight. what else can we do? And I was really struck, because that's not the gospel. The good news is surrender. The good news is that Jesus laid down his life. So I'll end with the answer I gave my mom. It comes from Matthew 5. If anyone slaps you on one cheek, turn to them the other also. If someone takes your shirt, hand over the coat as well. Pastor Jonathan J.P. Polkluda might be fighting metaphorical culture wars, but the sovereignty bit is real. What the culture wars need now is for white evangelicals to surrender.